Hi, I'm Nick.
Hi, I'm Thomas.
And this is the Unbossing Podcast.
A show about unleashing the full potential of every organization.
Welcome, Ravi, on our podcast.
Thank you. Happy.
And I'm gonna dive straight in, Ravi. The industrial revolution is over, and the emotional revolution is here. Explain us, please. Enlighten us why that is.
Okay, let's start with a big question. So I try to put the work that I do in a historical context. Where have we been as a society? Where are we now? Where are we going? Historically, I mean, let's say 300, 400 years ago, commerce was very simplistic compared to what it is today. You have local merchants doing local tasks. A blacksmith, a cobbler making shoes. And the nature of that commerce is very, very relationship driven. If you create friction with the customer or develop a bad reputation in your small village, your business goes down. But then a couple of hundred years ago, with the advent of the Industrial Revolution, we depersonalize commerce. You don't know suddenly the person who makes your shoes. They're made in some faraway factory. You don't know who makes most of the things that your family uses. It's a very depersonalized type of interaction. Now, we suddenly find ourselves in 2021 in a much different place. Today, retailers and people in business in general are adapting yet again because of the advent of social media and even a more cultural acceptance for people to be open about their feelings and open about their perceptions of products. Now, marketers want to know the emotional experience and actually try to create back to what may have been several hundred years ago. The pendulum has come back again now, where there is more of a relationship. We know individual people by name who are influencers or users of the product. And as such, we can't sort of depersonalize that interaction. You have to understand, why are they angry? Why are there comments on Twitter? Why are there comments on Instagram or TikTok or Pinterest or any number of them? And so now part of the business model is that engagement directly with the customer. And as such, if those interactions are done poorly on an emotional level, the brand will suffer. And in fact, the business will ultimately suffer. So in contrast, what we have to think about now is there's an emotional revolution. We have to understand how people feel. We have to be able to create communications that connect with them, not only from a pure transactional, here's the product, here's the features, here's the price, but much more on what is the experience about.
Interesting, right, Thomas?
It's extremely interesting having this historical perspective that it's coming back to the world of being a village, right?
Yes. Yeah, the world is now a village, exactly. And as a result, you have to change the way you conduct yourself, the way you see the entire business process.
Okay. And from what perspective do you look at these interactions between people today? From what background and what perspective do you assess and analyze and envision this?
For those who are listening to the podcast and haven't seen a photo of me before, I approach things in a most unusual manner. I am someone who always has a different color hair all the time. Sometimes I've had purple hair. At the moment, I have bright blue hair. And my perspective on these considerations in business actually comes, again, from a most unusual place. I spent my 20s many years ago. I spent 10 years in the science area. I originally have my background is in medicine and more specifically in neurosurgery. So I've studied the brain for a very long time. And after I had spent 10 years in science, I made a very big career change and went to go work as a management consultant at the firm of McKinsey. 5 years after making that change, I integrated the two. It was a most unusual conversation I had with a client where the client said something along the lines of, "Oh, I wish we would use our heart in this company." And I said, "What do you mean by that?" And he explained he meant, you know, a greater emphasis on the nature of people and behavior and how people feel. And I kind of laughed a little bit. And he said, "Why are you laughing? That's not funny. I'm serious." I said, "No, I take your point very seriously. And it is a noble thing to try to do, to run a business through treating people well. I just think it's funny that you describe that as happening in the heart." And he says, "What do you mean?" And I said, "Well, emotion doesn't happen in the chest. The heart is a pump that gets blood to organs. Emotion happens in the inferior frontal cortex and the cingulate gyrus and the amygdala, various areas of the brain." And he said, "I want to know more about that." So I did a small talk for his team a few days later. And now 15 years later, I'm still doing the same talk and telling people about not only how emotion happens in the brain, but when you understand how that works and apply it to the nature of leadership, the nature of business, the nature of how people are treated within an organization, then you can create the kind of culture that really breeds success, including unbossing.
Mm-hmm. And could you briefly explain us how emotion works?
It's an interesting biological phenomenon that emotion exists. For me, I take it from the perspective of, well, what purpose does it serve in human physiology? It actually becomes incredibly important for humans to have emotions. Without them, quite frankly, the species dies out and dies out rather quickly in the span of human history. The only reason humans can survive is we attach. We create emotional connections from our very first days of life. Compared to other species who are relatively autonomous from very soon after birth, humans are entirely dependent on others. It's impossible for us to do cognitive tasks early in infancy, and we can't do anything physically. Other animals are moving around quickly. Horses can stand within a few minutes or a few hours after birth. Humans take a full year to learn to walk. And the one thing that keeps infants alive is that they right away form attachment to others, and they can read the emotional signals of others, and they create through smiles, through play, through crying, a ability to communicate their emotional state to others. Now, much of it is instinctive, it's not thought through, but it creates this ability for us to attach and care for each other. The first lesson that an infant learns is, "I cannot live alone." So right away, we, from an early, early brain development level, it's interesting because we always say, oh, humans survive because we're so intelligent, we're so good at problem solving, and we've invented calculus and engineering and so on. And no doubt other species on the planet cannot do that. But our infants cannot do any of that. And if it's not for the ability for us to feel for the babies and to have this attachment in which they communicate back, it becomes nearly impossible for survival to occur, given that our infants are so developmentally born with no capabilities. Mm-hmm. Then that brain development occurs and emotion becomes part of the portfolio of skills that the brain can do. In addition to things like memory and cognition and problem solving, we learn to communicate. You might suggest that, in fact, one of the things that makes us such a dominant species on the planet is we connect better than other species do. If I have a problem and I don't know an answer that may even impact my survival, we have created a way that I can ask someone in Germany or in the Netherlands to get my answer, or anywhere. This ability to create these connections and to offer help to each other, to provide this kind of group connection, is what allows the species to survive. And the higher we see those kinds of connections to each other in a business, the more likely the business is to be able to withstand and adapt to change in the business environment. What exactly is happening with emotions? Well, it's scientific. We could get into details of when a certain set of events occurs, certain chemicals, neurotransmitters send signals back and forth to different parts of the brain. And the experience of that can be what we collectively call emotion. It's the response to what's happening in the environment at a very, very molecular level. But this collective set of billions and billions of neurons firing and signaling to each other what's happening in the environment, that's the nature of emotion. And it happens in so many areas of the brain with so many resources involved. It's a primary mode of how we live and exist in the world.
Mm-hmm. One side question, Thomas, before you go, is what is a characteristic of unbossed leaders and people working in unbossed organization is introspection. You know, that you introspect, like, what if there's, for example, a conflict in a meeting. You don't start pointing at the other person right away. You introspect first, like, what is my responsibility here? And part of that introspection is looking at your emotions and trying to make sense of them. And now I hear you saying that basically emotions are our experience of billions of neurons firing up in your body. So my question is, does it even make sense to try to understand your emotions, or is it more like being aware of them and accepting them in any moment? Or
there's a word that neuroscientists have used for many years, but is a popular word now in terms of how we think about the brain, and that is neuroplasticity. Neuroplasticity is the idea that the brain is constantly adapting. It's constantly rewriting itself. It's shaping and adapting in an agile manner to whatever it's exposed to in order to promote healthy long-term survival. And so as a result, when we are in a situation where we're doing introspection, we're providing, and this is an amazing thing, we're providing an organ and its an ability to change itself. So we're actually, through introspection, saying, hey, dopamine, norepinephrine, glutamate, and all these things that are floating around and signaling electrical activity, it can actually do, if you will, a self-diagnostic to then adapt and change and rewire itself. It's quite extraordinary. So introspection is a huge part of influencing the emotions of the brain. Interesting observation that some people make is that the brain is the one organ where the physiology of it in one person can actually affect the physiology of someone else. Because if my liver is sick, you may feel sympathy for me. You may see me and say, oh, I hope you can survive this. But ultimately, any processes that are abnormal or causing disease in my liver do not then change your liver. Just by standing near me, you don't then become shaped by the nature of my liver or my kidney or my femur bone in my thigh. But if my brain has a problem, if I have a reaction to each stimuli to shame and to shout and to belittle you, your brain changes. So illness or problems or dysfunction or, if you will, harmful patterns in one brain surround other humans around that, and that toxicity that's in one brain will actually spread to others in a domino-like effect. Whoa. And in the same way,
wow. So
can positive feeling. So my brain can collectively, almost like a viral thing, either create pain in everyone around me, or if I have a unbossing mindset, if I have a mindset to say, I need to shape others to be even better, then my brain, in a way, heals other brains around
me. Avi, this is a fantastic pivot for me. What we are dealing with almost on a daily basis, Nick and myself and our colleagues, executive teams staffed with extremely bright, extremely experienced people who believe in the rational part of their brain. I'm being careful now with what I'm saying. I avoid saying with their heart, Avi. I say they believe with the rational part of their brain that unbossing is the way to go. I say rational because they see themselves that the command and control structure is in no way a path to follow in the future in order to stay relevant. They understand that very well. They also understand very well that and see and feel that they are not able to attract anymore the talents they need, even if they have a world-class brand, even if they have a reputation for excellence, it's not enough anymore. And young talent is not accepting anymore many, many years of command and control structure. So that's why I'm saying they come to us, Ravi, and say, I understand rationally that we have to unboss. Then the next part of it, Ravi, and that's quite funny in a high percentage of the cases, they tell us, please unboss my company and keep me updated, guys. Tell me every month how far you are in unbossing all my people, and you have my full support. And then comes the fun part, because we say, no, guys, it starts with you. It starts with you and with your executive team. So then we have this first shock moment, and then we start working with this executive team. And now, Ravi, talking about emotions, it is so difficult to create an atmosphere of trust, an atmosphere of psychological safety in an executive team which has been trained not to trust each other, which has been trained to sit there, not as a member of a team, but as a representative of one's own kingdom within a corporation. And then going back to the real team, so to say, telling, okay, sorry, guys, my colleagues don't get it. My colleagues don't get it. And they don't understand that that would be the right decision. And I could not defend our interests, yeah, so to say. And coming from such an atmosphere and rationally understanding that unbossing and psychological safety and trust are the way to go, we see many of these, and I repeat, very bright people struggling with that. Now, first question, Ravi, do you feel what I'm talking about?
It makes total sense.
The next question would be, of course, Nick and I, we are giving inspiration. Nick and I, we are talking about personal experience. I can talk very credibly about my personal experiences within such a setting. But I feel that we are certainly not there of what's the best solution to such a common problem, Ravi. That's my question. What is it from your perspective?
Well, let me approach it in a two-part answer. The first part is understanding the path, again, from history, not from 500 years ago, but from each individual person's own history. Because what I see repeatedly is this lack of trust was not taught once the person was 25 years old. It was taught when they were 5 years old. And that is the burden or the challenge to overcome, because what do we do as humans kind of gets repeated billions of times over history. A young human, that is past that infancy stage, but still not quite an adult. Someone, let's say a small child of 3, 4, 5 years old, can verbalize, can interact, but doesn't know the world yet, isn't safe in the world. What do we do? The child will be in a public place with strangers, not just family. And children everywhere, it doesn't matter if you're in Africa or Myanmar or Australia or anywhere in the Western Hemisphere, small children wave at others. It's a biological reflex of this emotional triggering that happens in the brain to want to connect. So what do small kids do? Hi, mm-hmm. Hello. And they smile and they wave. And what do we very protective, well-meaning, loving adults do? We scold them. Shh. Don't wave at strangers. They could be dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
And we immediately tell this child whose brain wiring is survival depends on groups. The child doesn't know that cognitively, but the instinct of the species is connect into groups, build strength through more connections. Mm-hmm. Right away, we tell them, don't connect. Their instinct is to wave. Their instinct as small children in a classroom, 3, 4, 5 years old in a kindergarten, is to learn through interaction, to play together. And then suddenly our educational system changes that very abruptly. We say, sit in your individual desk and be quiet. Be quiet and do not interact with others. And in fact, if you interact, we may presume that you are cheating and punish that. And so over and over and over again, we teach this developing brain, don't trust, disconnect. Everything can be viewed from a lens of threat. So you can feel safe with mom or dad, but don't trust anyone else. And then even then, sometimes mom or dad then gives cause for lack of trust. And so the developing person may grow up to believe you cannot trust anyone. And then the crazy thing is, after this lack of trust and after these decades of being told, sit quiet, be quiet, don't talk to others, we throw them into a business situation and say, collaborate, which their brain is entirely unprepared for. So it is a kind of massive thing to ask that of people. Now, how do you change that? Well, people will have different points of view. And so my second point is, once we understand that's the history, so what do we do? I feel that it's very hard to change this purely through a lecture. I find it's very hard to do this kind of change purely through being passive, sitting back and watching slides.
Mm-hmm.
It has to happen through something that is interactive and allows the person to experience something. So it can be a conversation, but I actually, again, a little bit unorthodox, very American in my style, I use techniques from theater training. So what do you do when you're in a theater class? You learn to communicate something that a character is happening without words. Use your hands and body language, or learn to read the other person's emotion without verbalizing it, and learn to act and react based on techniques of really paying attention to all the ways we show emotion, both verbally and non-verbally. And so I actually, in seminars that I will do, I'll actually have people do exercises that force them to actually get out of the cognitive part of their brain and much more utilizing the emotional part of their brain. And it's uncomfortable. It can be difficult. It can be challenging. I know you had Jennifer Kane on an episode of Unbossing, and Jennifer very, very effectively will use improvisational comedy techniques. Again, simply to what her work will do is get those other parts of the brain engaged. And then when she has that type of effect with her teams, then really the whole brain is part of that organization.
Thank you so much, Ravi. In other words, the improv comedy magic, what Jen was showing to us, is such an example of a theater situation in which you would put such a team in. This is one example, right?
One example that is very verbal related. I will do exercises that are also communicate with each other without using words. So how do you do that? And I'll even do some where I say, and communicate this information now and don't use hands or movement. Do it simply through your face. And through those kinds of things and learning to read the most very basic of signals, people will change. One small behavior, for example, that I'll do just as a technique that anyone can practice, and suddenly it will change the way you interact with people. Everyone has been taught, you know, one of the ways we in our culture connect with people is make eye contact. And they say, yeah, I've heard about eye contact. I make eye contact. And I will do a simple little experiment. I will say to people, okay, look at the person next to you and just say hello and make eye contact. Then they turn to the person next to them and they say hello and make eye contact. And then I say, okay, look back at me. What color are their eyes? And people say, what? I have no idea.
What are you talking
they
about?
They look closer and they suddenly realize they have kind of gone into an automatic robot-like looking at the face, but they're not actually paying attention to what the person's face is showing, including the eye color. We've learned to tune out so many details as part of interactions. We ignore that. But when you do the simple task of making eye contact with someone, but focusing enough of your attention to notice what eye color they have, people will say to you afterwards, you know, you really are great at listening, or you're really a very effective communicator. And people who have been told the opposite, making this one small change, are perceived entirely different. This kind of behavioral change, this kind of technique, when you start to build a catalog of these in yourself, learning how to pay attention, how to listen, how to focus, you not only change that particular interaction, you create the foundation for more interactions to become effective. And you might say, well, this is all very nice, but unnecessary. You know, it's kind of, I'm busy focused on my metrics and my results. Mm-hmm. The problem is many of those metrics and results depend on human behavior. And so when we change these simples of behaviors, it creates a cascade, a building up of many positive influences. And that then leads to the possibilities of creative innovation because someone feels comfortable with a new idea. Or it creates the ability to address a problem sooner because people feel comfort, the psychological safety that you mentioned earlier, to bring up a problem. So back to Why is it? Why do any of this? Because in the end, it will affect the business.
Ravi, I fully agree with you. And Nick and I have experienced the magical effects of when the trust is there several times already. What we would like to have is an even faster and even more effective way in reaching this. And there we get now amazing inspiration from you. And I think Nick will agree. And I have one follow-up question, Ravi. You do that regularly with executive teams, I guess, right?
Correct.
Ravi, how do you bring these people who have been scientifically trained, who are very strong in their rational part of the brain, who have been conditioned over 15, 20, 25 years to thrive in this internal competitive environment? How do you get them to let loose and let themselves fall into your experiments?
Well, it is impossible to do if there is not a leader within the group who says, mm-hmm. we are going to do this.
Mm-hmm.
It's always the leader.
Mm-hmm.
The second factor that I think opens the door to the possibility is a failure. If there has been a failure that has brought great difficulty for the leaders, even perhaps disappointment, shame, embarrassment upon the leaders, they are willing to stop for a moment sometimes and say, why did that happen? How did we miss that so badly? How did we fail to execute the way we needed to? Why did we end up being mentioned on a website or in an article so badly? In many cases, just as we are as individual people, someone says to us, I have something better that you might try. People say, oh, I don't need it. But then suddenly when confronted with a loss, a pain, a disappointment, a frustration, the emotional trigger then lets people say, okay, well, I'm willing to listen at least. And then in those opportunities, that's when change can happen. It's unfortunate. It would be nice if everyone, including businesses, just looked and says, oh, you know what I need? I really need to be unbossed. And just, you know, would go jump to it. But very often the cognitive and that lack of trust part has kind of ingrained the opposite mentality. I mean, I'm sure you've seen the same. You have to find an opening sometimes that allows the conversation just to even occur.
I fully agree. Nick, what's your opinion? I tell you, I see it happening in front of me. I see these experiments of Ravi happening in front of me, and I find it fascinating. How about you, Nick?
Yeah, absolutely. And there's one big question that's on my mind for the past 10 minutes. And that is the strongest emotion of all is fear. So the way an individual, I'm not sure whether managing is the right term, but manages his or her fear, makes it either a bomb of energy that is directed at a target and high performance, or can completely, and that's what happens most of the time, block people. And so there's a lot of fear, and maybe in a lighter version, insecurities, but an insecurity is basically also a fear in organizations today. And we notice that just by sharing, if you create space to share these insecurities and these fears, to talk about it, that this has an enormous connecting power, because you see and hear that other people, they have different stories, but behind it there are the same fears and the same identical needs that they have. So it connects people through fear. Do you have anything specifically that you can share about fear? It's a very open question, but it's an emotion that fascinates me so much. And I was wondering. So my question is, what can you share with us about fear?
Fear keeps us alive. I don't want to be up here saying we must eliminate fear from every element of our life. It's impossible. It's part of why we survive. If you just think of the contrast, let's say humans somehow developed a brain that was incapable of experiencing fears. A lot of bad things would happen. When an attack is coming, we would not be mobilized to defend ourselves. When there's a problem, we would not feel, as you said, that stimulation to try to do something new, different, or better. So fear is a great gift that we have if it stimulates the right behaviors. The problem is the way the brain physiology is set up. Fear is terrific to motivate performance in the short term. When a predator is chasing us, fear gets us out of there. When we are faced with a crisis, many people will say, wow, how the team came together. Wow, how we rallied together in that moment and became really unified and delivered the result. The problem is the physiology, both from the brain, but also from the rest of the body, is not designed for chronic fear. It's not designed for an environment day after day after day of a punitive, toxic, you have no idea where you stand and you could be losing your role or losing your job or even under some other kind of more severe threat. The fear response from a physiology level is the brain perceives something, it sends signals out of the hypothalamus and the pituitary to the rest of the body, heart rate goes up, the adrenal glands in the abdomen send out hormones like cortisol to get our physiology primed for a fight or a flight type response. But the problem is that works great under a few minutes or a few hours. But if you leave those adrenaline levels up all the time and you leave those cortisol levels up all the time, you get chronic disease. And finally, you get fatigue, you get burnout, and you get apathy. I don't care.
Yeah, and especially if you, it's one thing to have that chronic fear, and then you also need to invest energy in not showing it. I mean, trying to mask the fact that you are in that state of mind, which is which comes on top, and which is, unfortunately, if you look at all the research on human capital in organizations today, the situation of many, many people and the current pandemic has impacted that even more.
I fully agree, Nick, and there comes again back my figure of the most tragic leader. The most tragic leader is the leader who had short-term success in a crisis situation with command and control. And this is such a dangerous situation. These short-term successes and this false experience out of it, that is my style. That is my style. I have my team around me. I tell everybody exactly what to do. I check regularly and very regularly. Is it done? Yes or no? I punish when it's not done. And I had tremendous success with it in this short-term situation, in this crisis situation. And that's what I take with me as experience. This is my successful style. That is what I call the tragic leader.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely tragic. And you can't generalize what worked in a crisis moment to a daily pattern, because from a physiology level, you really are killing your team. It's not just a kind of metaphor word. it really is. You're raising their blood pressure. You're raising their heart rate. You're predisposing them to have elevated blood sugar or kidney problems. That's what happens when cortisol just lingers for months or years on a team. And that's what safety becomes for me if we talk about it from a purely science physiology level. What is safety? It's when your cortisol can go down. And if you go into a situation where you say, this behavior seems almost irrational or illogical or volatile, that's partly brain, but it's also partly the entire body has been poisoned by having cortisol and adrenaline damaging the heart and the kidneys and everything every day.
I fully agree with this experience, Ravi, and it is fascinating for me, and I guess also for Nick, to hear this story, which I know and which I have experienced, to hear that out of this perspective. It's an absolutely fascinating thing to hear.
Yeah, and
the amazing thing is, it's so part of the biology, you can even see these kinds of physiological changes in children. You can even see the changes in the skin and the weight gain and so on in children, 5-year-olds, 8-year-olds, 10-year-olds living in stressful environments. Their physiology changes. They have a hard time losing weight. They just put on weight very quickly. They have chronic diseases now, even at ages 8 or 10. Of course, diet and lack of exercise and all that is part of it. But you throw onto it the physiology stress of living in an environment that has constant stresses around them. Their physiology does the same thing. So it's simply to say there's more evidence that a lot of this is not just all in our heads, but it's actually changing the entire physiology of the body.
Nick, are we ready for the famous question?
Well, we can talk for hours. I have the feeling with Ravi on this topic, it's so interesting, but indeed we need to wrap it up. I was thinking about it as well, Thomas, but didn't we just answer that question? So Ravi, the question is, what is the biggest mistake a leader can make when he wants to start unbossing his organization?
Or she.
And my feeling is, and I'm looking forward to hear your thoughts on this, Ravi, is that the biggest mistake is, you can't say it more explicitly, that is that if you don't create a context where people can address their emotions and listen to them, share them, connect with them, then you are basically, even physiologically, killing your people in the organization, killing your team.
That's exactly right. I wrote a book about 10 years ago called Emotional Business. And one of the pieces in that book people always tell me they found particularly insightful is, I put a small passage in there as a thought experiment or a kind of humorous story. I say, imagine that a new corporate office building was going to be built, and because the management was worried about productivity, they told the architect, put no bathrooms in the building. No toilets for the building. And might argue, well, we see employees waste too much time in the bathroom. So for productivity reasons, we're going to make sure there are no bathrooms. Yeah. Well,
and
course,
everybody says it's ridiculous.
It's ridiculous. And people would say, you have to have bathrooms. Even the lawyers and the legal community would say, it's not a luxury to have a bathroom. It's a necessity coming out of the biology of how human physiology works. And I believe that soon we will, as we understand more about the physiology of emotions, we'll put the same argument to put emotions in the workplace as for putting the bathrooms in the workplace. It has to be, because that's how the physiology of humans work. It's a necessity. If you take out the emotions, If you don't have a situation of safety, the physiology changes. So we need bathrooms in the workplace, but we also need emotions in the workplace.
Yeah, and this is a fantastic, fantastic way to wrap it up, Thomas. And it also links beautifully with the episode with Ang de Wilde from Absalon, who is creating these emotional bathrooms in her company. And listening to Ravi and how we are programmed early on in our youth not to trust, not to show emotions. Once you start doing that, and I think you agree, Ravi, we're not there yet. It's not the standard yet. It's messy because it's an entire new field. It's like we are going to the emotional bathrooms, but there are no bathrooms yet. So we it's all over the place. It's very shitty sometimes.
We are not there yet, but I think, you know, there's a podcast on bossing. There is clear need, and people are recognizing the need, and people are asking the question, is there a different way? Is there a better way to mm-hmm. achieve what we're trying to achieve? And the mentality of saying, no, it's only about technology and machines. We need human resources to put into the mm-hmm. machine. And being very, very kind of mechanistic about what people do, you know, isn't working, and people recognize that. And so a more emotional lens, a lens that understands that humans are this way, is ultimately what we need to do, particularly in an environment where there is such a strong force now towards automation, artificial intelligence, robotics, to do many of the tasks that humans used to do. There is no AI or robot yet that can understand how to create a relationship. And so that's where the humans have to be even better than they were in the past.
Yeah, that's our unique selling point in the 21st century. That's the one thing that makes us unique vis-a-vis the AIs and the robots of this world.
The question that you asked about, you know, biggest mistake, I think on a tactical level, if you're going through an unbossing program, if you're going through one of these programs, the one thing that it's a little bit counterintuitive is that companies usually try to start either at the top and do a massive program for the executive team that may take weeks or months before they ever start to touch the rest of the organization.
That's true, Ravi, and we are guilty of that.
I mean, it's natural, and I think that, you know, there's a benefit to making sure the top team is aligned on this. And some other groups I'll see will start at the front line and just try to create some type of program or cultural change at the front line associate level. But the mistake that I've noticed, which I try at least to guide people, is don't forget the mid-level managers soon. If you say, oh, yeah, we'll get to the mid-level managers in 9 months or a year or 18 months from now, that in the end, that's what people end up either leaving the company for. It's not, oh, yes, the company says great things, and I love the philosophy that my business unit had said about unbossing, but my specific manager is totally a boss and totally makes my life toxic and my cortisol go up. So the sooner you can get to the mid-level managers, that's what affects people's day-to-day experience in the company. So don't forget the mid-level managers when you're designing something to try to change the way you do work.
Thanks, Ravi. This is a totally unexpected turn and a historic moment in the unbossing podcast movement, because you are now really the first, and I think it's true, who says, show your heart for the middle management.
I mean, you know, they're often blamed for everything that goes wrong, and the top team or the front line take the credit when things go well. But in fact, if you really want to create this unbossing culture, of course the top team has to support it and role model it. And of course it doesn't matter to the customer unless the front line accepts it. But if I had my choice, I'd almost start in the middle intensively to kind of let it spread both higher and lower into the organization from that mid-level.
Aber ich kann es nicht die ganze Zeit so halten.
So, we are doing the recap with three people today, Thomas.
Yeah, I can also. She can be very persistent.
Yeah, take your daughter in this recap. Our listeners will love it. So, Ravi Rao, the neuroscientist, emotional business. What's your first takeaway?
Nick, I remember the storyline of Ravi who said, at the beginning of business, at the beginning of time, it used to be a very personal thing, ruled by personal relations within the city center, within the villages. Then came the industrial age, where it became very unpersonalized and anonymous. And now we are moving back towards this personalized and relationship-based business. And for me, this is one of our biggest impact points, because we say, Nick, that an unbossed team near to the customer is always, always stronger, an order of magnitude stronger than a team sitting at head office in a kind of UFO who is intellectually probably agreeing on this product and that product and that strategy, but has no relationship, let alone personal relationship whatsoever, with customers. What do you think?
Super, super interesting and very valid key takeaway. My first key takeaway, Thomas, is that our brain is constantly adapting itself to provide us with a long-term life. So in essence, Thomas, our brain is unbossed. Our brain is agile.
Exactly. And what does that remind us of, Nick?
Well, it reminds us like unbossed organizations are organizations who are inspired by how nature works. And how the brain or like a forest.
I agree. And me, I am reminded on our famous podcast with Günther Verheilen, who said, hey, what are you talking about? Making your people unbossed, making them agile. You don't have to make them agile. They are agile. Just take away all that bureaucratic clutter which you have built up during the last 50 years and which hinders them from being as they are.
Yeah. And so I found it super fascinating to hear from a neuroscientist that actually our brain is constantly evolving and working in a way like we want our organizations to work in an unbossed way. And to follow that up, I also found it super fascinating that our body and our brain is not built physiologically for chronic stress and fear. Stress can trigger good behavior in the short term, but is very, very toxic in the long term. And I link that with the vibe, the atmosphere, the culture in many organizations, where there's still often a culture of fear of mistakes, where people are, in essence, if you look at the burnout numbers, if you look at how many people feel disconnected from the organization, people are, in fact, in chronic stress. And then this neuroscientist comes and he says, well, the effect of long-term stress is not only negative on your own brain, but you are also impacting the brain of the people around you. Fear and stress kills. That's
a strong one.
If that's not a driver to change the fear culture to a culture of trust, I don't know.
I fully agree, Nick. And of course, it makes me think of many executive teams where people are sitting there not as member of a team who trusts each other, but rather as representatives of their tribe, who is mistrusting the other tribe, who is always on the defensive edge and is ruled by fear. And how would you like to be productive and bring out the best in everybody in such an atmosphere, right?
Would be a cool experiment to measure and monitor the physiology and the hormones and the brain activity of people in an executive team meeting or in any team meeting, you know, to really see what's happening there in the brain. Would be a very interesting experiment. Now, the solution that he stated, Ravi, was less slides, more interaction. And there you popped up again the aspect of improvisation. And that was, for me, also a key takeaway, the magic of improvisation.
Yeah, because I like it so much, Nick. Because with improv comedy, nobody in the room is able to stay without mistakes. Everybody in the room, whoever it is, will make him or herself a kind of funny subject within 1 or 2 minutes into the improv comedy. And therefore, I find it so powerful. And therefore, I find it so such a quick tool for every team. And certainly every executive team who is ready to go into that experiment.
It's really the ideal icebreaker to start the shift. And then to wrap
wonderful up expression, exactly.
And then to wrap up this recap, Thomas, what I find also very fascinating is that Ravi tends to start in the middle of the organization.
That was fun, Nick, right? Mm-hmm. Because it is 180 degree shift from what we, out of experience, are often preaching, where we say, guys, start at the top of the organization, take care of a grassroots movement, build momentum, and the middle will take care of itself. Mm-hmm. So this is a fascinating, a fascinating message of Ravi.
Yeah. And it got some good arguments going for it. So to me, in conclusion, yeah, how cool is it to get the unbossed perspective of a neuroscientist? I mean, and to find proof in the fact that actually our brain, so many similarities with how our body and our brain works already, you know, such as source of inspiration, nature. I think it's a quote of Einstein. He said, if you don't understand something, just look long enough at nature, and you will find the answer. It's a quote of Einstein.
That this is a great one. There cannot be another better wrap up for this.
Exactly. Now we're off to the next one.
Exactly.